Welcome to From Beneath the Hollywood Sign. If you love old movies, Hollywood history, or the golden age of filmmaking, you've come to the right place. This is the podcast that talks about amazing stories of Tinseltown from another era and fascinating conversations with writer-producer Steve Kubine and actress-writer Nan McNamara.
So, Steve, did Ava Gardner and Howard Hughes have a good relationship?
Well, they did, until he dislocated her jaw.
What?
Well, don't worry. She hit him back with an ashtray.
From Beneath the Hollywood Sign is the gin joint for you.
On this episode of Most Notorious, the short and violent life of a psychopathic New York City gangster named Francis Two Gun Crowley.
You know, the other part of it is Crowley could not tell the truth. He, for whatever reason, that he would lie to for anything, even when he didn't need to. It was all bravado, and he wanted to make himself look so much bigger than he was and tougher than he really was. I mean, he was a tough guy, but I mean, make himself so much like a gangster, and he really was nothing more than just a thug, you know?
Welcome, everyone, to another episode of the Most Notorious Podcast. I'm Eric Rivenis. How is everybody? Hope you are doing well, considering everything that's going on, of course. As always, thank you for tuning in. Anyway, on to the interview. It is so great to have as my guest today, Jerry Aylward. He is a retired detective with 32 years of service with the Nassau County Police Department. He also served 10 years with the U.S. Department of Homeland Security as a criminal investigator with the Office of the Chief Security Officer. And he is an author, and here today to talk about his book called Francis Two Gun Crowley's Killings in New York City and Long Island. Thank you so much for joining me. Merry Christmas, happy holidays.
Thanks for having me, Eric, and Merry Christmas and happy holidays to you too and your listeners.
Thank you. So Crowley is such a fascinating character. He was kind of a flash in the pan in the overall history of this period, but a really spectacular flash in the pan. How did you first hear about this guy?
Well, I first learned about Crowley, or they gave him a nickname of Two Gun Crowley. I first learned about him when I was in a police academy in Nassau County Police Department, going back years ago. And what happened was one of the instructors was given a little history of the department and who the first murdered police officer was. And he said that the killer was a New York City gangster, a young New York City gangster out of the Bronx, and his name was Francis Crowley. And he was notorious for carrying two guns, and that's where he picked up the moniker of Two Gun Crowley. And he also used both guns in some of his robberies and his shootings of police officers and things. So what happened was in the academy, when I heard that, I mean, I found it very fascinating and a little bit of the history, but I also found it fascinating that the instructor didn't really know too much about the occurrence of it when some of the other recruits were asking questions. He didn't know too much about it other than the first murdered police officer was Fred Hirsch, and he was gunned down by Crowley one night in May of 1931. And specifically, the police department was actually established in April of 1925. So, and there were a couple other police officers between the time that it was established and when Fred Hirsch was murdered that had died, but they were from on-duty accidents and motor vehicle accidents and motorcycle accidents. But Fred Hirsch actually remorsefully had the distinction of being the first murdered police officer. And as I went through the police department in my career, sometimes it would pop up a little bit about Two Gun Crowley and things like that, and not too much about the murdered police officer. So it always fascinated me that the bad guy was getting more of the notoriety than he actually should have. It should have been the victim, which was Fred Hirsch, who, by the way, he left four children and a young wife when he was murdered. And that's another part of the story that they had to deal with, his missing the father and things like that. But anyway, as I went through my career, I ended up in a precinct that of all the precincts within the county, and I ended up in one of the precincts where the one particular precinct where Fred Hirsch was actually murdered. And to make it even more interesting on my side, one of the police officers in that precinct happened to be the grandson of the murdered police officer. And that really piqued my interest. And I didn't really get into communicating with him too much about the history of what happened with his grandfather and things like that. But later on, and as I started writing things and looking at the history of certain articles on the death of Fred Hirsch, the murder and things like that, then I decided to write this book. And the History Press helped me out a lot. And what I did is I did my research, and I had a lot of help from a lot of different people, especially Sing Sing and New York City Police Department and the Yonkers Police Department. And they were very helpful. And John Jay College and a lot of other people, but we put things together, and I came out with this book. And and I believe it's an interesting read, and I believe that the story of how Francis Two Gun Crowley came into this world and how he left an indelible mark on society and for generations to come.
Yes, he definitely did. So Crowley had a pretty rough time growing up. Can you tell us about how things were for him early on?
Sure. So what happened was Crowley was born in 1911, October 31st, and he was born to an unwed woman, and her name was Dora Dietz. And what she did, she was 21 years old, she still lived at home, and her father had recently passed, and so her and her siblings had to go out and get a job and help her mother survive. And what she did, she took a job as a house cleaner, and she was a young girl, 14 or 15 years old. And she was a German immigrant, and she lived up in the slums. So she took a job to help the family, and the job she took as a house cleaner, she met a guy by the name of John Flood. John Flood worked for the railroad, or actually at the time they were the elevator railroads in New York City at the time. And he was a security guard, and whatever happened, whatever the reason that he actually came in contact with her at her employer's house as a house cleaner, whatever, they had a relationship, and she became pregnant. When she became pregnant, he didn't want anything to do with her. He wouldn't support her, so she had to go off on her own and with her mother. And in those times, you know, 1911. Or even latter part of 1911, and for years after that, an unmarried woman with a child, and it was socially and economically, it was very hard on them. So what she did is in October 31st, she gave her baby up for adoption to the Catholic Charities, and shortly thereafter, the Catholic Charities fostered the child out to a woman by the name of Anne Crowley. Now Anne Crowley had her own story. She was also recently widowed, and she had three biological children. And her husband, he up and died in the Bronx one day. And these were all people lived up on the Upper East Side of New York City. And he up and died at work one day, and that threw her and her children into an economic tailspin. And they had to move out of the house they lived in, and they had to move to the slums of Upper East Side. What she did, though, she was very inventive. I'm sure there's a lot of people who did the same thing, a lot of women. They fostered children because the foster agencies, the Catholic Charities and some of the other foster agencies would pay people to take the children, and they pay almost a dollar a week so they can get $6 or $7. And she created her own little business, and she had a little bit of a baby mill running and a three-room tenement apartment. She had at times up to 10 kids, including her own biological children. Well, she fosters young Francis, and she actually gave him the name but she never adopted him. She fostered him so she could keep the money coming in. And she started to get non up in the years and stuff like that. And because she fostered so many children, young Francis became a little bit of a truant problem and a behavior problem. And he kind of like slipped through the cracks, or maybe he was even forgot about, as long as he got the paycheck, that Ann Crowley got the paycheck. So he lived pretty much on the street. And when you live on the street, you live by the code of the street. And in those times, and even today, they up in the that part of the Bronx and Upper East Side of New York and things like that, they actually had a lot of gangs. And every community or every block had their own gang. And he started joining these gangs, and he started off as a petty criminal and things like that. And he didn't have a lot of things going for him. He was pretty much illiterate. The best he could do was write his name. He didn't go past the third grade. And all the years he was in school and stuff like that, he just kept getting in trouble. And he was removed a few times from her custody and placed in reformatories and things like that. And that just actually made it worse. But he did have a relationship with Ann Crowley's biological son, John, who was also major problems in his own right, behavioral problems and criminal problems. And what he did was he was big into gangs himself, and he was big into fighting and big into stealing, stealing cars. He taught young Francis how to steal cars as well. And young Francis became very good at it, or so he thought he was, and some of the local gangs and other gangs would come to him and ask him to steal cars for him. And pretty much he stayed on the cusp of being nothing more than a petty criminal until his brother, John — he called him his brother, but there was no blood relationship. There was a foster brother, if you will. They had a relationship with him like that, but John was much older. John was about 14 years older than him. And John, again, he was in and out of state penitentiaries, and what little time he did spend at home, he taught Francis how to be a criminal and how to take the things he wanted when he wanted them. And he gets himself killed by the police one particular night. And after that, young Francis vows to kill cops and go after cops. But he also had an underlying issue of an abandonment that his biological father, and at the time, if you were a security guard or you worked in security or you worked in protection, you were somewhat considered by the average person as being the police. And so being that his foster brother John was murdered, or he thought murdered by the police, it was actually a shootout, and he shot and killed a cop too. And the fact that he had abandonment issues with his biological father, he took a hatred towards police. And that was pretty much ingrained into him as he was growing up and as he lived on the street. So, and that was one of the other things that he knew, that he could steal, do petty crimes, but he could do a lot better if he had a gun. And he was, stature-wise, he was very short. He was, some say he was 5'3", others say he wasn't even 5'3". They didn't get past the 5-foot mark, and he would never weigh more than 110 pounds. But for an equalizer, he had a gun. And he always carried more than one gun, but he felt empowered with a gun and energized and think that he could do anything he wanted to do, because he would do a lot of robberies, and he would rob pedestrians, he'd rob stores, he liked to rob drug stores, and he would just rob anybody he could for money. And again, it was some tough times. It was the Roaring Twenties, but it was also, he didn't actually get to feel the Roaring Twenties because he lived in the slums, so he didn't get the benefit from that. But he saw everybody around him living that life, and he wanted it, and he wasn't educated, and he had some physical issues with his character and things like that. So he figured the best way to do it is take it with a gun, and that's what he did.
So besides being shorter than average, he also suffered from a bit of a stutter. And one can assume that he was probably bullied when he was a kid, which might have contributed in some way to his development as a criminal.
Yeah, that was very big into it. I mean, and again, education-wise, he was poor. He lived in a foster home with many other fostered kids, and so wasn't properly dressed. He wasn't properly cared for. He didn't get the development that he should have gotten. And yes, he was he did have a stutter, and he had he also had a slang, the Upper East Side ghetto slang. I mean, they talked different, they acted different, and yes, he was picked on, and the only way to equalize that was to break away for one thing and go off on his own, but also to arm himself with a gun so he could have an equalizer.
So the nickname Two Gun, was there a specific incident that led to the creation of that nickname?
What happened was, for the most part, I mean, he was always a petty criminal and doing stick-ups and things like that. But his decline, if you will, was started around the 22nd of February, 1931, when the American Legion in the Bronx had a party. They had a dance. They had a George Washington celebration dance. And after the dance was over and the guys from the American Legion were cleaning up and things like that, they received information from a neighbor that there was a noisy crowd outside, and obviously it had to do with drinking. However, Crowley admitted, even under testimony, that he didn't drink nor smoke, which you can believe that or not. But anyway, two of the guys in the American Legion go out in the parking lot to find out what's going on, and they get into a little bit of tussle and with a couple guys, and Crowley pulls a gun and shoots both of them. Now, of the four guys that were involved in that fight, and both the guys in the American Legion were shot and wounded. They didn't die, but they were shot and wounded. A New York City detective gets assigned to the case. Ultimately, all of three of them were picked up for various charges, and including the shooting at the American Legion. But Crowley was pretty much bouncing all over the place. He was all over the Bronx. He was all over New York City, and it was pretty hard to trail down. But this detective actually finds out that he's going to meet his brother-in-law, who had a business on Lexington Avenue on 41st Street in Manhattan. And so he makes arrangements to meet him, to surprise Crowley when Crowley is going to meet him on Friday. And he's there when Crowley walks in. And he surprises him, places him under arrest. He has him at gunpoint. He puts his gun away, turns Crowley around, removes one gun from his waistband, not knowing that he had a second gun. Crowley, being small, wiry, manages to slip out of his grip a little bit, but he pulls a second gun that he had in his coat pocket, and he shoots and kills. Actually, he didn't kill him, but he shot him a couple times, and the police officer fell to the floor. And as he's getting away, he fired a couple rounds at Crowley, but he didn't get Crowley. And that's where he picks up the moniker of Two Gun Crowley. And now in New York City, a lot of cops in New York City are on the hunt for this guy, Two Gun Crowley. And that's what starts everything with. So it's kind of like he starts on a spiral of going downhill pretty much around the 22nd of February until he makes the ultimate and shoots and kills the Nassau County police officer.
When we come back, Two Gun Crowley's callousness and hot-headedness lead to murder.
Everybody shush! William Shatner has something to say.
Cat and Jethro, box of oddities.
What do you do when the woman you love dies? Well, of course, you dig her up and you live with her.
Aww.
The show examines weird things.
There are plenty of old photographs from this time period of children out in the streets playing in and among the dead horse carcasses.
Oh, I miss those days. Things used to be so much simpler.
Cat and Jethro.
Then there's the urine wheel, which sounds like a really bad game show.
They've done weird things. Cat and Jethro, box of oddities. That is really mysterious.
Join Cat and Jethro Gilligan Toth for the strange, the bizarre, the unexpected, as they lift the lid and cautiously peer inside the box of oddities.
The Webby Award-winning Box of Oddities podcast from Airwave Media.
The storm broke in Chattanooga one night in 1906. When a young woman was the victim of a violent crime. From that moment, the city knew no peace for four furious years. At the center of the storm was the notorious inmate, Dave Edwards, who was awaiting trial on murder charges. After a high-profile case threatened to go cold, the desperate county sheriff did the unthinkable by freeing Dave Edwards from jail and deputizing him to track down the fugitive. Grievous Deeds, 4 Years of Fury in Chattanooga, Tennessee, written by Kimberly Tilley, narrated by Samuel Burst. is the most amazing true crime story you've never heard. Listen to Grievous Deeds, the audiobook, available on Audible, iTunes, and Amazon.
Back again. So at some point, Crowley picks up a friend named Fats Duringer, and they made quite an interesting pair, you write, visually.
Yes, absolutely, they did. What happened was because Crowley was living and he was bouncing around and he was not really hanging out at home and stuff like that. His mother was, his foster mother actually got married late in life. She was like 57 years old and she married a gentleman. He was 58 years old and they moved out of the Bronx and they moved into Queens, which is the county that borders Nassau County on Long Island. But he never went with him. He would go over there once in a while to visit. For the most part, he didn't stay there. He lived off the streets continually, and he would hang around some of the dance halls and places like that. And at the time, which was very popular at the time, were dance halls called, where they had diamond dancers called taxi dancers. And a gentleman could dance with a young, pretty girl for 10 cents. And they usually ran from like 8 o'clock at night till 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning. And it was pretty popular throughout New York City. They estimated that at the time between the 20s and the 30s, they had over 100 of these dance halls. And so that's where Crowley would hang out. And he would hang out at the more seedier ones. And again, that's pretty much where the only place that he actually could have any chance with or could dance with or communicate with or talk or have any social association with a pretty young girl. And what he did is he kept hanging around this one particular taxi dance hall called the Primrose Club up in the Bronx. And that's where he meets another guy who's Rudolph Duringer. And Rudolph is a big guy. He's well over 6 foot, so he's got Crowley by almost a foot, and he's got him by at least 100 pounds. And they became quick friends. His nickname was Fats because he was a big guy. They called him Fats. He may have been a little slow in responding to things, and some of the court reporting and testimony and records, they referred to him as a dimwit. But anyway. He became fast friends with Crowley, and they went around doing stick-ups and robbery. But Duringer actually became infatuated with one of the young dancers who just came from Maine, and her name was Joyce Brennan, Virginia Brennan, but she owned by the name of Joyce. And this Primrose Dance Club was more on the seedy side of the dance clubs, so there may have been some prostitution, there may have been a lot of alcohol. But again, Fats became infatuated with this young dancer, and one particular night they were out drinking, and actually had been drinking for a whole weekend, and they went to pick up Virginia when she finished her dancing. And they picked her up, and they were heading up into the Yonkers in the northern part of the Bronx, and when she told Fats that she wasn't in love with him, he took out a gun and he shot her once, and he shot and killed her, and they dumped her body up in the Yonkers, which started a big investigation, murder investigation of the Yonkers PD, and it brought right back down to the Primrose Club because they ID'd her, and because she had some identifying paperwork in her pocketbook that they recovered at the scene of her murder. And one thing led to another, and then they got the information on Crowley. And Crowley knew that they were looking for him, and Crowley actually boasted about killing her. And Duringer had a big drinking problem, as big as he was, and he was actually from Osney, New York. But he pretty much stayed in the apartments that Crowley would rent, and he would rent them under alias names and things like that. And this way he could jump around the city and pretty much hide from the cops and be on the lam. And what he would do is he would steal a car periodically, and then he would drive out to Long Island, and he started getting very familiar with people on Long Island in certain areas in Nassau County, because he did have some knowledge of a family who used to live on the Bronx near him, and he knew that they moved out to Merrick, and he would visit them periodically. And this is how it came to be that he was spent so much time out in Nassau County, and he actually had a Nassau County girlfriend out here. He met a girl at the beach. on the South Shore, and he had a relationship with her, and her name was Helen. And Helen was only 16 years old, and she was different than the girls that he knew. She was educated, and I think what she really came down to be, Helen kind of liked bad guys, bad boys, and Crowley was infatuated with her, and this was his girlfriend because he even promised to marry her and asked her to marry him, gave her an engagement ring. But one particular night, May 6th, that they were sitting in the Lover's Lane in North Merrick, and the police were looking for information on they got a complaint of some stolen tires in the area of Washington Avenue and Roosevelt, North Merrick area. And two police officers, one of them was Fred Hirsch, and the other was Peter Yotis. Peter Yotis was the rookie of the two. And they went looking for him. And when they approached Crowley with his girlfriend, Helen, in a Lover's Lane area, that's when Crowley opened up and shot Patrolman Hirsch.
He really unloaded on Hirsch as well. 16 bullets in his body. I think you're right. He did not hold back.
No, it was just rapid fire. He had him. He surprised him. There was some conversation at the car and some conversation with Helen, but for the most part, he just opened up on Hirsch, unsuspecting, because Hirsch wasn't really interested and didn't think he was going to go that way. Didn't pull his own gun, and he shot him many times. Yes.
So you mentioned Hirsch left behind four children. From how you describe him in your book, he seemed to be a stand-up fellow, a very kind man.
Yeah, he actually had a good reputation. He was he actually moved out of the Bronx, him and his wife, and they settled in Belmore, Long Island, which really wasn't too far from where he was actually murdered. It was the next town over. Two towns over, but geographically wise, it was probably only maybe a 15-minute drive. But yeah, he was a very good police officer. He was he wasn't selfish, and he thought a lot about it. As a matter of fact, he didn't actually have to be there that night. He could have went home because Patrolman Yotis was relieving him, and he was just finishing up his 4-12 tour, and because the desk officer had authorized Patrolman Yotis to go look for these three suspicious guys stealing tires. And again, this is his personality. Patrolman Hirsch said, no, I'll go with you. I don't want you to go alone. And because you don't know where you're going, you're taking your own car, I think I better go with you. He could have went home, and he didn't. And he even had a reputation as, even with some of the local kids, as doing the right thing by taking care of a couple tickets. And he wasn't the roughneck or hard-boiled police officer that you would find in the streets at the time. He was sympathetic. He was community-minded. People in his community liked him. He would help his neighbors. He was pretty much into this house and things like that, taking care of his house. And above all, it was his family that mattered more to him than anything else, and his community. So, yeah, he left behind a wife, three daughters, and one son.
So part of what made it probably a little bit easier for police to connect the murder of Officer Hirsch to Crowley was, as you said, his relationship to this local girl named Helen Walsh. But he was also hanging out with a local neighborhood group of kids who called themselves the Black Shirts Gang.
That's correct. And matter of fact, that's where he was shot and killed on Morris Avenue, which was also, the kids called it the Black Shirt Lane. So what happened was, because the local kids, and they also had their own gang out here too. They had the Black Shirt Gang, and they would all live within walking distance from Black Shirt Lane. And it just so happens that after Hirsch was murdered, and they were at the scene, some of the kids that knew Hirsch and stuff like that, they walked down after they hearing all the gunshots and the disruption of the night. They walked down to the scene, and And that's when they identified, they knew that it was Fred Hirsch. But what happened was there was a police officer, a uniformed police officer there to keep the crowd back. And he overhears that statement that one of the kids says, oh, that's Hirsch. That's Patrolman Hirsch. And the cop said, you know him? And that's when they got the information that, yeah, they knew he was there. They knew, and they're the ones that gave up that it was Crowley who was in the car. And Helen Walsh was in the car with him, because two of those guys had actually been in the car with him earlier, and Two Gun Crowley actually kicked him out of the car so he could spend time with Helen in the car alone.
So where did Crowley and Helen go after he murdered Patrolman Hirsch?
Well, after he shoots Hirsch, they manage to get the car out from around Patrolman Yotis's car, and they fled in the dark, and they fled back to New York City. They went as far as the Jamaica train station. They abandoned the car. Now, the car, this particular car that they were in, was stolen, so they had no they were going to take any plates off it or anything, but they knew enough to change plates because the cops were going to be looking for that particular plate, or they thought so, or Crowley thought so, because Crowley had also shot out part of the windshield. And what they had to do, he had to break out the rest of the windshield so the cops wouldn't stop him being a suspicious car, and they changed the plates. But he abandoned the car in Jamaica train station and took the train back into New York City. And from there, he took cabs back around to West 90th Street, the West End Avenue area in Midtown Manhattan. That's where he had an apartment with one of his dance hall girls by the name of Billy. And they were up on the fifth floor. They had rented a little fifth floor flat up there. And when he goes up into the, on the run from the Long Island cops, he goes up into the flat, and he wakes her up, and Derringer's in another room. He's hiding out from the police from the murder of Joyce Brennan. And he wakes her up and tells her to get out of there. He brought a real girl into the apartment. And he's going, and she should go now and stay with Fats Derringer in the other room. So he pretty much told her, you know, you're done. And she actually had given an evil eye to Helen when they're in the bedroom, and Crowley didn't like it. And he actually pops her one, and he hits her in the face and tells her to go in the other room. So he had a real mean streak, and he was violent, but he was also, he could turn real quickly, and on the girl who was hiding out with him in New York City, moving around, and who he met at the Primrose Dance Hall, he turned on her very quickly.
So an intense manhunt starts for Crowley. How did they eventually locate him? How did they figure out where he lived?
What happened was right after he killed Patrolman Hirsch, and they identified as Crowley as the killer, they put out an all-points bulletin, and went throughout the United States. It was in every paper. It was in the early edition. It was in the late edition, and everybody was looking for him. Meanwhile, they actually had sightings, and information was coming in from all parts of Long Island, and they knew that Helen was with him, and they actually believed that the police actually believed that he was going to kill Helen because she was a witness, but it was just the opposite. And what they did is, unbeknownst to all what's going on with Crowley hiding and everything and the information going on, there is two detectives from New York City who are now investigating the shooting of one of their own. And when they get word that it was Crowley who was the one who shot and killed Hirsch out in Long Island, then again, everything was beefed up a lot, and all in New York City, all the police were looking for him because they believed he went back into New York City. And that's where the two detectives, Mara and Queso, actually got word that through their information, through another girl at the Primrose Dance Hall, that they were held up at Crowley's dance hall girlfriend in her apartment. That's how they actually went around to the West 90th Street address. And that's where they got the information. He was up on the fifth floor, held up with Derringer and Helen.
When we return, Jerry Aylward shares the incredible story of Two Gun Crowley's two-hour gunfight against police officers from his New York City apartment. And we're back. So police surrounded the building. You show a photograph of it in your book, and it's pretty incredible that the scene is wild. It had to have been really hard for police to lay siege to an apartment, a fifth-story apartment. Narrow staircases, other tenants living inside.
Yeah, and they had to do it quickly too, because they didn't want to lose them. They had information from a couple shopkeepers that they shown them photos and stuff like that, and said, yeah, they believe they're up there now. Just so happens that the apartment across the hall was vacant, so they actually a couple detectives got in there, and then they lined the stairwell for five flights, and they acted like they were plumbers. They acted like they were traveling salesmen. They all put on a ruse and an undercover atmosphere that they could actually, they thought that they could go up there and then kick the door in and grab them unsuspectingly. Well, what happened was they had a signal, and the signal was that Detective Mara, who had knowledge of the building, had knowledge of the area, was acting as a plumber, and he was going to give the signal after everybody was in the apartment across from Crowley's, and everybody was, and their detectives were lined on the stairwell. Now they had no communication. There was no radios, handheld radios or anything. So everything was line of sight or codes. And what they did is decided on, he'd bang on the pipes, and that means for everybody to get in position. And when everybody's in position, they would make their final move and they would bust the door in and grab Crowley. Well, it worked to some degree. What it did is brought Crowley in and Derringer outside of the apartment, and they were looking down to the stairwell and they wonder what the noise was. And for whatever reason, and Crowley did have a sixth sense. He did have it. He was paranoid, but he also was cautious, and it saved him a couple of times. When he heard the noise, he thought something was wrong, so he started going back into his apartment, and the detectives in the next apartment thought that they were going to lose the opportunity, so they started shooting, and that's when everything disrupted, and Derringer and Crowley were firing back at the, and they would fire through the walls, and they'd fire down through the door, and fire down through in the stairwell, and the siege actually lasted for almost 2 hours, and they finally had backup. Police officers had backup coming in, and they had brought long guns in so they could shoot through the doors and through the walls. While they were shooting through the windows, and the cops had surrounded the courtyard in the rear, and they had covered the front of the building, and they actually had their emergency service unit up on top of the roof, and they cut holes in the roof, throwing smoke bombs into the apartment, and. Meanwhile, while they were doing this, Helen Walsh was loading the guns for Derringer and for Crowley so they could shoot at the cops, and all the windows were shot out, and the siege was 2 hours long, or almost 2 hours long, and they had a couple hundred cops at the time surrounding the place. They had there were snipers up on the roof, and then they had the adjoining roofs, and they had machine guns, and they were shooting the place up. But there were times that they actually stopped, and there was no firing coming in, and there's no firing going out, and that's when Helen, being only 16 years old and stuff, she wanted to pen a few notes to her sister and to her mother. And one of the notes that she was writing, she wanted her mother to know that she was a good girl, and that she wasn't in that lover's lane having a petting party, meaning that they weren't or having sex or anything like that. She was a good girl, and she would never do anything wrong. Meanwhile, here she is, the most notorious gangster that the cops had dealt with in a long time in a 2-hour siege in New York City, you know, so.
Yeah, and not only did she write a note to her own family, but Crowley dictated a note to her as well. I guess he didn't have time to write it himself, too busy shooting at police. I found the note to be completely absurd. Would you mind reading it for us?
Sure. What happened was he couldn't even, he was busy and he was keeping the cops at bay and everything, but he couldn't write it. He could barely write his own name. So this is a little bit of the dictation that he was given Helen as she's writing it. So I'll just read the little paragraph that she wrote out for him.
Yeah, that'd be great.
To whom it may concern, I was born on the 31st, She was born in on the 13th. I guess it was fate that made us meet. When I die, put a lily in my hand and let the boys know how they'll look. Underneath my coat will lie a weary heart, what wouldn't harm anybody. I had nothing else to do. That's why I went around bumping off cops. It's a new sensation of its own. Take a tip from me to never let a copper go an inch above your knee. They tell you that they love you, but as soon as they turn your back, they'll club you and say, what the hell?
Oh, God. Yeah.
But it's interesting that he had this little thing in about put a lily in my hand and let the boys know how they'll look. When he wrote that, or that was his dictation to Helen, the warden at Sing Sing actually gave him a lily at the end, you know?
One of the many interesting things about the siege, police were throwing tear gas into his windows with 7-second fuses, which actually gave Crowley enough time to toss them back out.
Yeah, they would throw them through the window, and they had these 7-second fuses. But by the time, it doesn't take but 2 or 3 seconds to land through the, after they light them and land through the hole in the roof and land on the floor, they would take them and throw them out to the outside to the cops in the courtyard. And the more bombs they would throw, tear gas bombs they would throw through the ceiling, they'd be throwing them out the windows at the cops down below. So it was just it was chaotic, and it actually started overcoming the cops in the stairwell. So if they didn't hold on that long, it would have been a real mess later on with so much tear gas and the cops couldn't see either. So it was time. Plus, it was 2 hours, a long time to be standing on the stairwell and shooting at cops and having them shoot at you. So
how did this standoff finally end?
Well, he actually said he actually gave up. I think he gave up for Helen's sake, because he had been wounded a couple of times. He had been shot in both legs and one arm. Actually, he had an old wound, which probably came from one of the chases earlier, a few weeks before in the Bronx. But he actually gave up. I think what he didn't want was Helen to get hurt. But he didn't care about himself, because he did tell the cops, come and get me, coppers. He didn't care. And they had witnesses, and testimony was that he was running. They could see him running back and forth from window to window up on the on the fifth floor, where they didn't see anybody else. He was just running from window to window, shooting down. And he was like a one man army, and he was taking on the police. You know, he's shooting up through the holes and the ceiling at the cops. But he did finally say, we give up. And that's when they went in and they kicked the door open. And he said, we're out of ammunition and everything. And he wasn't. He had much more ammo, and his guns were all loaded and everything like that. But, you know, the other part of it is Crowley could not tell the truth. He, for whatever reason, that he would lie to for anything, even when he didn't need to. It was all bravado, and he wanted to make himself look so much bigger than he was and tougher than he really was. I mean, he was a tough guy, but, I mean, make himself so much like a gangster, and he really was nothing more than just a thug, you know?
Yeah. And they found Duringer stuffed under one of the beds. And Helen later said that he had spent most of the gun battle hiding in one of the closets. And it was Crowley who had been doing all of the shooting.
Yeah, exactly. And Duringer wasn't nothing more than just an overzealous drunk. And it came a little bit of question was whether that he did he actually shoot Virginia. You know, Brennan, did he actually kill her? Because there were other testimony that Crowley actually did it. And they did. They did match Crowley's the slug taken out of the car that killed Virginia. They found that slug did come from Crowley's gun, but Crowley said that he gave the gun to Duringer. And Duringer could have been so drunk he just didn't remember. But anyway, one of the elements of the crime of murder and for the penalty of death, you had to have a premeditation. So you had to have a premeditated murder. So when they asked, when the investigators asked Duringer, did he think about killing her or did he just kill her? Was it a matter of just hate because she didn't love him anymore? Or did he think about it? He said, no, I thought about it for 2 or 3 minutes. And then I picked out the spot where I wanted to do it. So that little statement there alone is what, and after the conviction, is what got him executed. You know, that was his premeditated.
Yeah, I found that very interesting. So he admits that he killed her because she claimed she didn't love him. She loved somebody else. But later, wasn't it Crowley who had bragged that some guys had paid them $150 to bump her off because she had talked too much about something?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, there was another gang that thought that she knew too much about their organization or what they were doing, their stick-ups and things like that, and that they paid them, him and Derringer, $150, actually $300. They each got $150 to bump her off. So, and again, was it bravado? Was it for shock and awe? Was it to tell, because the witness that he told actually testified against him and said that. But he never disputed it. He said, yeah, it was his gun, but he gave it to Derringer. So, and that could be possibly true because he was always giving guns away to people, you know, because he always can get more. So it was kind of a, and things, what happened was things moved quickly. The justice system moved much quicker than it does now. I mean, comparing the justice system to today, to the justice system of 1931, 1931 is like the speed of light. You know, for trials, they indicted him on Friday, and he was standing trial on Monday, you know, for murder. So, you know.
Yeah. So this was the end of May, May 25th, 1931, when Crowley went to trial. What was his demeanor through the whole thing?
Well, he enjoyed it. It was almost like a sideshow for him. He was indicted on the 8th of May. And what happened was that the defense attorney asked for time to prepare his case to defend him. So they gave him 2 weeks. Otherwise, it was going to start on the 11th. So they gave him 2 weeks and he had to the 25th. But his demeanor was, he actually assisted in his defense by picking the jurors and stuff like that. And he would just say, I don't want this guy because he looks like a cop, or he's already made up his mind, I'm guilty. He thought it was a little bit of a game show because he would turn around to the audience and the courtroom was packed, and he would always smile and he was always chewing gum and he had the smirk on his face, and he was actually enjoying it. He actually liked the notoriety and the attention that he was receiving.
What strategy did his attorneys use? I mean, did they think they had a shot in hell of getting him off?
No, not really. What they did want, they didn't want him to be executed. And what they thought they could do is, the defense was that he didn't have the IQ necessary, that he could understand that what he was doing was a crime, and that's what they did. They actually had psychiatrists. They had a psychiatrist for the state and a psychiatrist for the defense. And what they did was they testified that, the state testified that he knew what he was doing, and the defense said he didn't know what he was doing, that he was nothing more than at the level of an imbecile at the time, and he should not be held accountable for the actions for the execution to be executed, and he definitely to serve life in prison, but they wanted to spare his life, and to do that they would have to show that he was mentally incapable of understanding what he was doing.
Among other witnesses called to the stand, Helen was called, and she had defended him earlier, but when crunch time came, she turned on him. Did I state that correctly?
No, yes, that's exactly what happened. When crunch time came, and then she actually took the stand, and she was face to face with him, she wasn't hard on him. She told him what happened. She told the court and the jury what happened. But yes, earlier she was defending him to some degree, and she wanted to see him, and she wanted to stay in touch with him and things like that. And later on, after the testimony, and she gave a true testimony of his actions and what he did, and Hirsch and shooting Hirsch and how he died. But later on, when she wanted to see him when he was sent away to Sing Sing, he wouldn't see her because he figured that all she wanted to do was learn more of the story, learn more of his life, and so she can go sell it to the newspapers and make some money. And that's what he was worried about. But he never saw her again.
So in contrast to her, Helen, his former girlfriend, Billy Dunn, who, as you already mentioned, had been walloped pretty hard by Crowley in his apartment, she actually stuck by him and came to his defense. She was definitely more of a traditional gun mole type, right? Wouldn't you say?
Yeah, exactly. And she was not much different than him. She lived on a hard life. She lived on the streets. She was dancing for 10 cents a dance, and she was only making a profit of a nickel out of that because the other nickel went to the house to pay for the dance hall and for the orchestra and things like that. But yeah, Billy was running around with him. She was going from apartment to apartment, running from the cops and everything and hiding him. And she wasn't really giving him up or anything like that. And she was protective of him. Even when she thought she was going to testify, I do believe that they didn't use her, but she was there to testify. I think she probably would have testified in his defense. She would have said everything that was good for him because she didn't like the fact that Helen was telling the truth on the stand. And it was not looking good for him. And she said that it was Helen didn't love him. She loved him. That's why she was there.
So how long did it take for the jury to reach a verdict?
I think overall, I think it was 35 minutes. I think from the time that they only needed one ballot in the juries, they didn't have to go around or they just only had to vote once and the ballots and they had the verdict. So they wanted to get in and get out. And the other thing was he pretty much sealed his own fate. One of the other things about it was it was May and it was unseasonably hot for May in New York at the time. So it was very muggy and there was no air conditioning. They had fans and all the windows were open. And I think they just wanted to get it over with because Crowley was a thug and he was a cop killer. And they just did one ballot and found him guilty and went to the judge and said, yeah, they haven't reached a verdict. You know, it was one of the records for Nassau County, the record for a verdict for murder in first degree.
So Crowley's time in Sing Sing. I know often criminals who get sentenced have a come to Jesus moment, come to a realization that in order to have a shot at an appeal or even a pardon, they have to at least attempt to walk the straight and narrow while in prison. How did Crowley do? Was he a choir boy?
Yeah, absolutely not. No, as a matter of fact, when the verdict was read in the courtroom, it started in the courtroom. When the verdict was read in the courtroom, he immediately he tried to get a hold of the sheriff's gun. A fight ensued, and the struggle ensued with different officers and he fought them and he was trying to get away and he was an opportunist. He wanted attention, so he was doing everything he could. And even when they was the following Monday when they was sentenced and the sheriff's department were taking him up to Sing Sing, and they get to Sing Sing and they search him, they find that he had fashioned a knife out of a spoon and he had it hidden in his sock. So he was doing everything, but he wasn't going peacefully. He was always going to have attention. He was going to hurt somebody or he was going to try to escape. And he did that a couple of times. He was not a model prisoner. He set fire to his everything in his cell and he flooded his cell with sticking clothes down the toilet and he was as he was true to form. He was a behavior problem as he was growing up. He was a behavior problem in jail. And he even, when you go into, when the condemned, when you've been sentenced to die, the condemned go to the death house. And the death house is in a prison is separate from the prison population itself. And he managed, and you can never see or you can't see the prisoner next to you. You can hear him talking and you can talk, but you'll never see his face. And he happens to manage to get communication with somebody who looks like him and who is wanted for some stick-ups for drugstore stick-ups in the Bronx. And they gather a little story together that if he can get a second trial, this guy O'Brien can get a second trial, and Crowley will say that it was him that was doing the stick-ups and not O'Brien. O'Brien will get off, but it'll give Crowley an opportunity to get out of the death chamber for a day or two, and he can make an escape. And that's what he did. But he was so heavily guarded that he never had the opportunity to escape again. He was a forward-thinking criminal that anything he could do to get out. And I mean, Sing Sing's had a lot of issues and a lot of escapes and things like that. But here is, he's 19 years old and he's doing it, you know?
Yeah. So how long did he sit on death row?
Well, he got there on June 1st. So when he was sentenced in Nassau County that particular day, they took him right away. They took him over to Sing Sing, which is up in Austin, just on the Hudson River. And he sat there from June 1st all the way till December, beginning of December, when O'Brien had his retrial. And then after the retrial, they brought him back. He was marked for January 21st for his execution. So he actually spent about 7 months, a little over 7 months, on death row, which was longer than Derringer. Derringer was executed on December 10th, and it happened to be Derringer's birthday. So, you know.
So when it came time for Crowley to die, did he face it calmly, peacefully?
Yeah, pretty peacefully for the most part. Yeah, he didn't go he didn't go kicking or screaming or anything like that. He had his last meal and he spent his last few hours with his family with his foster family, Ann Crowley. And some of the interesting notes with that is that they had to get court appointed permission to visit him because they weren't blood relatives. He had no blood relatives that anybody knew of. And his biological mother wasn't coming forward. What she did is, just before they were bringing him the day for the execution, she had sent him a package, and in the package was a rosary and a note from your mother, you know, love mom, and that's kind of interesting because at the end, when they strapped him into the electric chair, he still had the rosary in his hand, and they took it away, and he was asked, did he have anything? Any last words before the execution was carried out? And he said, send my love to mom. So he, in a roundabout way, he did have some sort of communication with his biological mother because he had none all the time he was growing up. So it was until the end that she actually came forward and acknowledged him, you know.
You write in your book that he had actually seen his mother once when he was much younger, right?
Yeah, he did, but he didn't know who she was. She actually had come to the apartment and spoken to his foster mother, Ann Crowley. And when she left, there was a communication going on. He couldn't hear what it was going on or what was said or the words. When she left, he asked who it was, and his foster mother said, "Oh, that's your biological mother." And he says, "I don't care. I don't like her." But he didn't mention anything about the father, you know, his biological father.
What were his feelings towards Fats Derringer at the end?
Derringer had, he still had a relationship with Derringer, even though they couldn't see each other, didn't communicate other than maybe talk and yell between bars and stuff like that. But Derringer actually had put on a lot of weight in jail because he wasn't exercising, not that he was exercising anyway, but he was eating quite good. And what happened was on his day of execution, he couldn't finish his meal, and he gave it to Crowley, and Crowley finished it. So they did have a somewhat communication, and there was no hard feelings between the two of them.
So I have a question for you, something that I ask all of my guests with a law enforcement background. I hope you don't mind. What was the most memorable case that you were involved in your career?
Well, I didn't have just one. I guess I had quite a few of them. I've had quite a few murders. I've had quite a few robberies, and I suppose the one of the more notable ones, and not that it was violent or anything, that violent or anything like that, was Joey Buttafuoco. You know, remember the name?
Oh yeah,
yeah. Yeah, yeah. Well, Joey Buttafuoco was you know, we're involved in that and stuff. But I mean, I've been involved in murders where they're very violent, some home invasions and things like that. So I have there's a couple that haven't been solved. So I really wouldn't want to get into that, but there are always one or two that you never forget. And I have a couple of those, violent rapes, where the perpetrators randomly grabbed a girl and raped her, the gang raped her and beat her up and left her for dead and stuff like that. I've had that. I've had a few of those, but, memorable, and you know, I don't mean to be, you know, comedic, but Buttafuoco is kind of a funny one, you know?
Yeah, there have been television movies made about that one.
and too many. They've worn that out, Joey Buttafuoco was nothing more than just a crackhead. You know, his living off his mom and dad's money. That's all he was doing. You know.
Yeah. So, your book, I know it's available in bookstores and online.
Yes, it's in bookstores. It's online and. And even a couple of libraries have it, or you know, if you want to get it, if you're interested, someone is interested in the book, they can email me and I can give it, or I have my webpage, you know, website that they can go to, you know.
Yeah, tell us about your website. That would be great.
My website is www.jerryaylward.com. No spaces, all lowercase. And they can get it through there, or they can leave me an email address. I have an email address, or they can leave a message. They can email me from my website, which is jerryaylwardauthor@yahoo.com. And then I can get a signed copy to them and personalize it for them if they like.
Did you enjoy the writing process enough to start thinking about writing another one?
Yeah, you know what? I had so many people. I had, you know, New York City Police Department. I had Yonkers Police Department. I had the guys from Sing Sing. They don't know me from Adam and stuff like that, but they're all so helpful. A lot of guys went above and beyond for the story. And I think even in the book where I put down that the Sing Sing guys actually said this was a fate. This was because they had so much information. They knew about it. And Sing Sing's had their share of people that they knew about him, and he had a notoriety in Sing Sing still. So, you know.
Wow. Well, thank you so much for your time. This has been great fun.
Yeah, thank you, Eric. I really appreciate it. You know, thank you for the opportunity. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, no problem. Again, I have been speaking to Jerry Aylward. He is the author of Francis Two Gun Crowley's Killings in New York City and Long Island. This has been another episode of the Most Notorious Podcast, broadcasting to every dark and cobweb corner of the world. I'm Eric Rivenis, and have a safe tomorrow.